Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A tense moment. Extraordinary security measures are put in place amid nationwide threats of violence as the presidential transfer of power approaches. Then, the Biden agenda. We discuss the president-elect's plan to control COVID and provide economic relief with one of his top advisors. Plus, the longest war. We report from Afghanistan on the potential impacts of the drawdown of U.S. troops. And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider the second impeachment of President Trump and the tense atmosphere in Washington ahead of the inauguration. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The nation enters this weekend on edge about the coming presidential inauguration. Investigators are still delving into the trauma that shook Washington on January 6th as authorities brace for what is yet to come. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
It is a city in a state of emergency, a capital heavily guarded and on edge. National Guard troops are arriving in an unprecedented show of force, and crews install fences ahead of next Wednesday's inauguration that officials fear could turn violent. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser.
I think that our entire country has to deal with how our intelligence apparatus, security apparatus at every level deal with a very real and present threat to our nation.
Authorities say they've approved 25,000 National Guard troops to patrol the district. Military, congressional, federal, and local officials agreed on the request to prevent a repeat of last week's failed insurrection that killed five people and injured dozens. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today she'd been assured requests for help will not be brushed aside.
It depends on the intelligence, and we have to have more security than the intelligence might warrant. I think in this case, redundancy may be necessary.
Meanwhile, states are also bolstering security. Police, National Guard, and fencing are going up in state capitals from New Mexico to Michigan.
The number of people that will be present over the course of the next 7 to 8 days particularly, and then from a state police perspective, all the way through the, at least through mid-February, will be significantly more than we've seen in the past.
More significant than before Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. Federal watchdogs from agencies including Justice, Defense, and Homeland Security are now investigating the failure to protect Congress. And authorities today revealed more details of the siege's organization and objective. FBI official Stephen D'Antuono said on a call today, more than 300 suspects may be identified by the end of the day, and 100 are already in custody.
If this investigation was a football game, we'd still be in the first quarter. So let this be a reminder, the full force of the FBI is investigating the heinous acts we saw last week, and we will leave no stone unturned.
The Justice Department said there was no evidence of plots to kidnap or kill lawmakers, but a court filing against Jacob Chansley, an Arizona man seen storming the Capitol in horns and face paint, said the intent of rioters was to capture and assassinate elected officials. The Washington Post reported the mob came dangerously close to Vice President Mike Pence, who stayed in the Senate chamber for 14 minutes after the Capitol had been breached, despite rioters threatening him by name. Also under scrutiny, current and former military and police. The Associated Press found at least 21 took part, wearing military-style gear and employing tactics like this Ranger file formation. And a current member of the Virginia National Guard, Jacob Fracker, and a fellow police officer were arrested and charged with participating in the riots. Acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Michael Sherwin.
We don't care what your profession is, who you are, who you're affiliated with. If you are conducting or engaged in criminal activity, we will charge you and you will be arrested.
Besides these immediate security concerns, when President-elect Joe Biden takes office next week, he'll also be facing the enormous challenge of the coronavirus pandemic. Last night, Biden unveiled a major legislative package to address the twin health and economic crises that have spun from the pandemic. His $1.9 trillion plan includes $1,400 in additional direct payments to taxpayers, $400 per week in unemployment benefits through September, $400 billion to help fight COVID-19 and reopen schools, and $440 billion in aid for states, cities, and small businesses. Last night, he spoke about the urgent need for the federal government to help stem further economic fallout from the crisis.
I know what I just described does not come cheaply, but failure to do so will cost us dearly. The consensus among leading economists is we simply cannot afford not to do what I'm proposing. If we invest now boldly, smartly, and with unwavering focus on American workers and families, we will strengthen our economy, reduce inequity, and put our nation's long-term finances on the most sustainable course.
We want to begin tonight looking into President-elect Biden's plan. And for that, we turn to Heather Boucher, appointed by him to be a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Heather Boucher, welcome back to the NewsHour. This is a lot of money, $1.9 trillion, on top of the trillions that were dished out by the federal government last year. Why is so much money necessary?
Well, Judy, thank you so much for the question. Let's step back and look at the situation that we're in. We continue to have an economy that is in crisis because of this pandemic. And while we've taken serious steps, the pandemic still rages and millions of people are out of work as a result. So the package that the president-elect talked about last night focuses first and foremost on containing the virus, doing the things that we need to do to get schools to reopen safely, to make sure that the vaccine is distributed equitably and all those things, while making sure that families and businesses and communities all across the country have the support they need to weather this crisis and come out on the other side just as strong, if not stronger. So we need to continue to help folks through this crisis, and that is why we have this package in front of us today.
I'm sure you know, Heather Boucher, that a number of Republicans and even some Democrats, like Joe Manchin of West Virginia in the Senate, are saying it's all well and good, but it's money that is not targeted enough, the additional $1,400 in direct payments. And it is asking the government to go even deeper, a government already in debt, to go even deeper in debt. What happens if Congress cuts back on this proposal, doesn't give you as much as you're saying is necessary? Frankly, the way Congress cut back on what President Obama was asking for back in 2009, and you were part of that administration.
Well, let me tell you, right now, the risks of doing too little are far greater than the risks of doing too much. And that's one of the lessons that we take from the last decade, that in this moment of crisis, we need to make sure that we keep the economy running. The costs of inaction will be greater than the debt that we will incur as a result of taking actions today. You think of the millions of people who are out of work, the extent to which they don't have income through this period of unemployment, which is no fault of their own because of the pandemic, that is then leading to businesses all across our economy who aren't seeing customers. And so by helping them, by helping those small businesses stay afloat, we're making sure that our economy is on a stronger footing going forward. So I think that looking back over the past decade is really a smart and important thing to do, and so many economists have. And the consensus, I think, really at this point is doing too little is the greater risk.
We are seeing more and more economists, as they look ahead to this year, say, yes, the first part of the year is going to be really tough, but they are forecasting it by the middle of the year, more people get vaccinated, that we're going to see economic growth take off, that we could end up with more than 4% growth overall in this year, 2021. Do you share that outlook?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time listening to the health experts, and I know that just like 2020, where we are starting 2021 is a place of great uncertainty about what's to come, right? We know that we have this new strain of the virus that's more contagious, and while we have the vaccines, the distribution rollout has been too slow so far. So we need to make sure that we're taking steps now to make sure that aid is available, that we're supporting communities, local governments, small businesses, so that hopefully we do get to that stronger economy in the latter half of the year, that we do put in the time and the investment to make sure that everybody gets this vaccine, that we do put in the time and the investment to make sure that we're making schools safe to reopen so that we get there. But I think that the big uncertainty now is, will we be able to get to that higher growth place? And that really requires that we take action now.
Heather Boucher, you have written, you've spoken a great deal about the need to not only address economic growth, but also to address the pronounced and growing economic inequality in this country. How will the Biden administration do that at a time when there are so many stresses around us?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, Judy. You know, one of the things that we saw in 2020 is that it showed us what inequality looks like. It showed us how a pandemic was hardest hit among the lowest income families, families of color, workers of color, all across the economy. It showed us where our vulnerabilities were and how by not attending to that, it made our entire economy and our society weaker and made it harder to recover from this virus. So as we look forward, you know, this package, this American Rescue Plan, really is a down payment on addressing economic inequality and addressing systemic racial injustices in our economy. As you look at each piece of the package, they are targeted at making sure that those who need the most help get the most assistance. One of the things that I'm really happy to talk about is that scholars at Columbia University have just come out with some estimates that this package this year will cut child poverty in half, and it will reduce poverty among Black families by a third. So the package that the president-elect talked about last night really is a down payment on addressing some of these incredibly important economic inequalities.
And finally, in a nutshell, what is it going to take in the way of higher taxes, higher revenues, in order to pay for some of these things that you've been describing? What income level is going to be hit and what kind of tax?
Well, that is certainly a very important question. So for right now, we can afford to spend this package through deficit financing. But you're right, moving forward, we're going to have to think about the fiscal situation. Now, during the campaign, the president-elect outlined a whole series of tax increases focused primarily on those at the very top. He committed to not raising taxes for those making less than $400,000 during the campaign and making sure that we fix the tax system and make it more fair, while at the same time encouraging domestic production, encouraging businesses to produce goods and services here at home, and to make sure that those workers are fairly paid. So there's a lot of different options there. That's not tonight's problem, but it's certainly something that we're going to be talking about in the weeks and months to come.
And we look forward to having those conversations with you and asking those questions. Heather Boucher, incoming member of President, will be President Biden's Council of Economic Advisors. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, COVID-19 has now left more than 2 million people dead worldwide since it emerged in China just over a year ago. The pandemic passed that milestone today, led by the U.S. death toll of 390,000. Meanwhile, the CDC forecast that the COVID variant, first seen in Britain, may become predominant in the U.S. by March. Word from the White House tonight is that President Trump will depart Washington on the morning of the inauguration. The NewsHour also confirms that he may take part in a farewell ceremony at Joint Base Andrews before he flies to Florida. Mr. Trump will break with long-standing tradition in skipping the inauguration of his successor. The timing of President Trump's Senate impeachment trial remains undecided. The Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, declined to say today when she will send the lone impeachment article to the Senate. For now, House impeachment managers are preparing their case, accusing the president of inciting insurrection.
They're now working on the taking this to trial, and when they, you'll be the first to know when we announce that we're going over there.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the trial will begin no earlier than January 19th, and it could commence on Inauguration Day itself. In North Korea, a major military parade in Pyongyang showcased new weapons overnight. State media showed Kim Jong-un looking on as submarine-launched ballistic missiles and others rolled by. Kim is pledging to expand North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Thousands of migrants in Honduras have begun to head north in the year's first caravan destined for the United States. They had gathered at a park before starting the journey. Some blame grinding poverty that was made even worse by two powerful hurricanes last year.
We're emigrating from the country because we have lost everything in the hurricane, and we cannot be satisfied with what has happened to us. So we're going to ask for help from anyone who will take us in.
In Guatemala and Mexico, thousands of soldiers and police are set to bar the migrants' way. The two nations cracked down on caravans under pressure from President Trump. Back in this country, the National Rifle Association has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The gun rights group said that it will reorganize and move from New York State and reincorporate in Texas. New York has filed suit to dissolve the NRA, accusing its leaders of diverting $64 million for their own use. And on Wall Street, stocks lost ground after reports showed that retail sales and consumer confidence are declining. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 177 points to close at 30,814. The Nasdaq fell 114 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 27. Still to come on the NewsHour, extraordinary security measures are put in place amid nationwide threats of violence. The COVID vaccine campaign continues to struggle amid skyrocketing infections and deaths. We report from Afghanistan on the potential impacts of the drawdown of U.S. troops there, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast called Shots in the Back, Exhuming the 1970 Augusta Riot. This series chronicles a large uprising in Augusta, Georgia, after the murder of an African-American teenager in the county jail. During one day of rioting, six black men were killed by white police officers, all shot in the back. This series is a co-production of our promotional partner, Georgia Public Broadcasting, and the Jesse Norman School of the Arts. Shots in the Back, Exhuming the 1970 Augusta Riot, is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Returning now to one of our top stories, the unprecedented show of military force to defend the peaceful transfer of power. And it's not just here in Washington. Nick Schifrin has more.
The FBI says there are threats to all 50 state capitals this weekend when federal authorities warn there could be armed protests. In Pennsylvania, there will be 450 National Guard protecting the Capitol in Harrisburg. The Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor is John Fetterman, and he joins me now. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, welcome to the NewsHour. What's the threat that Pennsylvania faces, and what are you doing to protect your Capitol?
Well, I mean, the threat isn't necessarily a specific one, it's more a general one. And the governor had taken the preemptive steps to close the Capitol complex all next week. So if they do have a protest, which, of course, as long as it's peaceful, that's, of course, their constitutionally protected right to do so. And in the event that it does, you know, get out of hand, which I don't expect that it would, there is a robust presence there that would deter anything that go along those lines. When I was just at the Capitol this past Tuesday, we had armed National Guardsmen with automatic weapons. And there's a much different vibe and a much different energy than there was just 1 week ago when I was there, when it was a very casual, laid-back atmosphere, even though there were a couple hundred angry Trump protesters right there on the front steps.
Are you getting enough federal help?
I can't speak to that specifically, but what I can say is that this is an issue that has been the number one priority for the governor and the Capitol Police Department in Harrisburg, and they have taken every preventative step to make sure that there are no exposed vulnerabilities, that the complex is shut down. And I really, again, don't anticipate that there's going to be anything on the order of what happened in in Washington last week, especially since no one's there and the entire complex is closed this entire upcoming week.
You said there was no specific threat. I wonder if we could talk more generally about that general threat. The FBI, just a few months ago, labeled Pittsburgh a hub for white supremacy, for extremist groups. Is that a particular concern for you going forward?
Well, you have to consider every angle. I mean, last Wednesday in Washington changed everything. I mean, this idea that you would have a mob take over the entire Capitol complex was unheard of, unprecedented. No one thought that. And that's why there wasn't the kind of security there, because no one ever believed that that was possible. So, you know, after that, everything's possible. And there is an entirely new level of scrutiny and possibility that is being considered to make sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power and that there is no kinds of insurgency certainly in Harrisburg. And I suspect all across Pennsylvania as well, too. The National Guard and the governor's office is in close contact with all other law enforcement agencies. And as I said, there isn't a specific plot in mind that I'm aware of, but nevertheless, everyone is on high alert just to make sure that everything goes smoothly and whatever protests there are peaceably, constitutionally guaranteed rights to protest.
You say anything is possible. I'm wondering if you could help us understand this moment we're in U.S. history. Pennsylvania, of course, one of the original colonies. It ratified the Constitution in 1787. Here we are, 233 years later, talking about insurrection. Where are we today as a country?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I watched those events on the television where they took over the Capitol, much like everybody else did. It felt very 9/11. It felt very surreal. But what we have to remember is on the upside that the guardrails held in America. And Pennsylvania was the target of more smears and lies regarding our electoral security than any other state. And at the end of the day, we had three instances of voter fraud out of over 7 million ballots cast. And the Justice Department, the president's own Justice Department, just signed off on the fact and said there wasn't any fraud or any activity that would closely resemble that in Pennsylvania. So, you know, what kind of a new era are we in? We're in an era that we were not able to take the peaceful transition of power for granted, like we were able to for the entire history of our country. And that needs to change. We can never look at that again. And we also have to confront this idea that when you are maliciously lying and creating and fomenting chaos, that can't be permitted on a platform that affords you to spread things in an unprecedented speed to an unprecedented number of people. And this idea of slapping a warning on these kind of things, you know, that doesn't include the fact that but for this idea that this election was stolen and rigged and they're trying to steal this country from you. I mean, there's a straight line from those kind of incendiary statements, banging, you know, repeatedly being tweeted, retweeted, and repeated for 2 months straight. And it all culminated in what happened in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's a lot that has to be considered. So this is never, ever part of the American story again. And we can get back to one of the pillars of our democracy, and that is the peaceful transfer of power.
John Fetterman is the Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania. John Fetterman, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Judy?
And now, Nick, let's turn to another story that you've been reporting on today. Last night, you described a series of policy changes that were announced at the very end of the Trump administration. Tell us what the Biden transition team is saying to you in response.
Yeah, Judy, many administrations rush through policies at the last minute, especially when there's a change of party. And the administration has rushed through policies on Yemen, Cuba, Taiwan, and Iran. So far, the Biden administration had been shying away from criticizing individual policies, but that changed today. A Biden transition official in an interview told me, quote, we will manage this, but if it does start at some point to feel like sabotage. The official singled out the designation of the Houthi group in Yemen over the objection of humanitarian groups who say that that designation will make the world's worst humanitarian disaster even worse. The Biden transition official told me, quote, Secretary of State Pompeo is literally risking hundreds of thousands of lives. Most of Yemen is at risk of starvation so that Mike Pompeo can feed his own domestic political ambitions. This is childish and silly, and we're not going to let it box us in. In response to that, a senior administration official told me, quote, we are designating the Houthis as terrorists for a simple reason. They're terrorists. The Houthis and no one else are responsible for the humanitarian crisis Yemen faces. But Judy, even humanitarian groups today are calling for that designation to be rescinded.
And Nick, I know there's so much to report on, but just in brief, what are the main foreign policy challenges that the Biden administration is going to face from the very beginning?
Yeah, the challenges are widespread, and the plans on day one for the Biden team in terms of foreign policy are rejoining the World Health Organization, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, and rescinding executive orders that ban travelers from majority Muslim countries. In the first few days, the Biden team will have to figure out how to extend the New START treaty. That is the treaty that governs American and Russian strategic weapons. And in the first few weeks or months, the Biden team will kickstart diplomacy with Iran.
Nick Schifrin covering security issues in this country and abroad. A lot on your plate. Thank you, Nick. As we reported, one key piece of President-elect Biden's plan to fight COVID is to make major changes to how vaccines are distributed around the country. It comes as the Washington Post reported that the vaccine reserve the Trump administration had just promised to ship to states does not actually exist right now. Several governors were furious, calling the administration's prior statements, quote, lies and deception on a national scale. William Brangham looks at what Mr. Biden hopes to do.
Judy, the president-elect outlined these following steps and more. Allow more people to get the vaccine, including those 65 and older. Deploy FEMA to set up thousands of community-based vaccine centers in stadiums and school gyms and community centers. Get national pharmacy chains involved as quickly as possible. And use the Defense Production Act to make more vaccine-related supplies. It's worth noting that so far, only about a third of the 30 million vaccine doses that have been distributed have actually ended up in people's arms. Joining me now is Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, and he's also the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, great to have you back on the NewsHour. Before we get to the Biden plan and vaccines, I wonder if you could just give us a snapshot of the pandemic right now. I know people are frustrated and they're tired about this, but thousands of Americans are still dying every single day.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're in a dire public health crisis right now, bordering on a homeland security crisis because of the depth and breadth of this epidemic now. Right now, COVID-19 is the leading cause of death in the United States on a daily basis. It's been this way for about at least the last month, maybe 6 weeks. We're looking at 4,000 deaths per day, and that so the number is going to get to around 400,000 deaths per day by around the time of the inauguration, which is an important benchmark. That's the number of American GIs who sacrificed their lives in World War II. So we're looking at something on that scale. And we're continuing to head to 500,000 deaths. So this is a humanitarian tragedy, to say the least. And the numbers are extraordinary, 200,000 to 300,000 confirmed cases per day. And that's an underestimate by a factor of four. So we're looking at a million new cases a day. And without any COVID-19 national program in place for 2020. We've squandered every opportunity to do that. We've missed the entry of the virus coming in from Europe back last spring. We never got diagnostic testing up to speed. We failed to stop that southern surge in the summer, the fall surge in the Midwest. So now our backs are against the wall. All we have left, our last arrow, is to vaccinate the American people. And now we've learned that's not in place now. So this is absolutely critical what the Biden administration is doing to, you know, our last hope is to vaccinate our way out of this.
So many challenges ahead. As I mentioned, incoming president announced more of his plans today. It sounds very similar to a plan that you laid out in the Washington Post. Could you briefly explain what you believe the Biden administration needs to do immediately to make sure as many vaccines are available as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I laid out a four-part plan in the Washington Post, and it looks quite similar to what the Biden administration is proposing. First of all, we don't have an adequate infrastructure for vaccinating lots of adults. We have to vaccinate 240 million adults, we estimate, to interrupt virus transmission by August. So that means with two doses, 2 million Americans every day. We're not going to do that with the pharmacy chains alone and the hospital chains. Now they're doing a good job. I mean, if you look, the pharmacies are doing all they can. And let's face it, most adults get their vaccine through pharmacies oftentimes. But it won't be enough. We're still going to have to add additional vaccination hubs, large high throughput centers. Remember, huge undertaking. When we talk about 2 million Americans every day, that's 10 to 50,000 Americans per day in the large metro areas. We're just not even close to that. So that's a major component of the Biden plan. I was happy to see that. We're also going to have to streamline guidelines because they're a bit too fussy if you're trying to do something at that high throughput. We've learned in 2020 that our health system just cannot do complicated things. We have to keep it extremely simple. And the phase 1A, B, C guidelines, I think, were well-intended. And if you had a functioning system in place, we could probably operationalize those, but not in this circumstance. So we're going to have to streamline that. That's the second point. The third is we don't have enough vaccine. The mRNA technology looks really great in terms of protective efficacy, but it's still a young technology and not robust enough to scale it to the level that we need. We're not going to be able to do this with mRNA vaccines alone. We have to get the other vaccines up there. We need the two adenovirus vaccines from J&J and AstraZeneca Oxford, the particle vaccine from Novavax. We have a recombinant protein vaccine that we're developing and scaling up now to a billion doses with Biological E in India. We've got to get those up to get the vaccines. And then lastly, we have no communication plan. We've not conveyed any of this information to the American people, or when they're going to have to get boosted with a third dose, or what the durability of protection is, how we're going to manage all of these issues. And of course, we've got a pretty aggressive anti-vaccine movement we have to counter. So a lot of work ahead.
A lot of work ahead indeed. Dr. Peter Hotez, always good to hear your counsel. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Defense Department announced today that the United States, which once had over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, now has 2,500 service personnel remaining, completing a goal President Trump had set. It is the lowest number of American troops in Afghanistan since 2001, when the U.S. first invaded. Here's Amna Nawaz.
That's right, Judy. These reduced force levels come as the Afghan government and Taliban peace talks are stalled. For more on the situation there, we go to special correspondent Jane Ferguson in Kabul. Jane, welcome back, and it's good to see you. So tell us what these means, these reduced force levels. What do they mean for the situation on the ground?
AMNA really sends a strong message on the ground here to the Afghan forces, to the Afghan government and people, that the American government intends to stick to that February 2020 deal that the Trump administration signed with the Taliban. And that's despite, as you have mentioned, increased violence, the attacks on the Afghan forces by the Taliban, and stalled talks. So whilst that context continues and the bloody fighting continues here, there is, of course, a complete recommitment to that deal and to that timeline to draw down the troops. So it actually ups the pressure here and a lot of the fear of what's going to happen if the Americans fully commit to that deal and really do pull out completely by the end of April.
So this is the seeing through of the Trump plan. But what does this mean for the incoming Biden administration that's going to inherit the situation in Afghanistan?
For Biden, he not only inherits America's longest war, and one that, of course, he himself, was going on while he himself was vice president under Obama, he also inherits now this deal that Trump has signed. So he is in a position where everybody in Afghanistan, whether it's the Taliban or it's the government or the people stuck in the middle, are all watching Biden, wondering, will he follow through on this deal? Will he try to negotiate for an extension beyond that May first deadline to pull every last American troop out? Or will he honor the deal, in which case he could be throwing the country into potential chaos? And in the meantime, can the two sides that have sat down for talks but not had very much progress reach a deal by then? That's even less likely.
Jane, you mentioned those peace talks. They've been working for years to get to this level of participation. What do we know about the future of those talks today?
We know this is the greatest opportunity for peace in Afghanistan since the Bonn conference after the U.S. invasion that toppled the Taliban government. But the challenges are enormous. Not only do these talks come at a time whenever there's still bloody fighting going on between the two sides who are talking, but there's also an increased pressure on the government here. I mean, their position is that essentially the deal between the Taliban and the Americans has vastly weakened their leverage. They have released 5,000 Taliban prisoners just to get these talks going. And now with the Americans continuing to commit to their withdrawal, with their complete withdrawal by May, that leaves the Afghan government or the Afghan negotiators from Kabul in a quite a weakened position. And we have to remember as well that from the Taliban perspective, and they've been saying this vocally, that they feel as though they've won this war. So from their position, this is a win-win.
And that is special correspondent Jane Ferguson reporting for us from Kabul. Jane, good to see you.
Thank you.
And now for the final Friday analysis of the Trump presidency, we turn to Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you on this Friday evening. So, David, it was just two Wednesdays ago that there was the attack on the Capitol. Five people died as a direct result of that. Then a week later, President Trump impeached, with only a few days left in office, impeached a second time. Was it the right thing to do?
Yeah, absolutely. The Yale political scientist Brian Garston made the point that our system depends on an equal branch of government, that we have an executive branch and we have a legislative branch. And the executive branch can't just go off inciting riots to take over the legislative branch. And that's more or less what just happened. And if that's not an impeachable offense, then nothing is. And so I think they were right to impeach. I have to say, emotionally, I feel somehow weirdly that impeaching the president of the United States is still emotionally overshadowed by the events that happened on January 6th and by the turmoil that has been set off within families, within churches ever since. So the impeachment happened, but we're still reeling as a nation in a way that seems to me somehow even larger than that.
What about that, Jonathan? What about the move to impeach and about where we are left as a country after January 6th?
I think the move to impeach was necessary. It had to happen. We're reeling from it now. I agree with David. We are reeling from it now. But I think when we read about this in the history books, that folks will see that it was a necessary thing, not just to hold President Trump accountable for inciting people to insurrection to try to overthrow the American government, but to send a signal to anyone who might come after Donald Trump to signal to them that if you try to do the same thing, that there will be consequences. And then what this says about where we are as a country, Judy, I think we are in, I think we're at the beginning of the middle. This is not the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. What we are now about to talk about in this country is about deep fissures and deep pain within this country that's centered around race. It should not be lost on anyone that those insurrectionists going up into the Capitol were Boogaloo Boys, Proud Boys, but they were also white supremacists. And most notably, the person who was carrying that Confederate flag in the U.S. Capitol, the Confederate flag, a traitorous flag. That person, thankfully, has been arrested. But what he represents, what that insurrection represents, is something that we're going to have to talk about.
So, David, where do we go from here? I know that's a big question, but and in particular, what about the Republican Party? You had 10 Republicans in the House. Hardly, it's not very many, but it's more than certainly the last time the president was impeached. And you now have a Senate that seems to be open to an impeachment trial. Where does the Republican Party head and the American people still divided over what happened?
You know, I did a lot of reporting this week on the white evangelical church that has been so the backbone of Donald Trump's support. And you found some people really doubling down on Trump, saying it was all Antifa, et cetera, et cetera. You had a lot of people, the majority of people in the white evangelical church saying, this is not, how did this happen? The John Hagee, a very Trumpy pastor in Texas, said that was not patriotism, that was anarchy. And so what you're seeing, and a lot of people who have made these comments against the marchers, against Trump, have received vicious backlashes. And so this is, in a way, a weird democracy in action, the Republican Party trying to figure itself out. And I happen to think the Republican Party is reasonably well poised, postured to do decently politically over the next few years. But meanwhile, half of the party is detached from reality. And so how they figure out how you reattach people to reality, to facts, how you address what Jonathan talked about, the racial issue, the economic resentments. I've lost track of how these things are all separate. Somehow race, extreme nationalism, Christian nationalism, it's all economic anxiety. It's all become fused into one poisonous fiber. And that's hard for a party to expunge. But somehow we need two responsible parties, and that's part of the job.
And Jonathan, clearly a lot to sort out here, and it's not just about the Republican Party, the people who are supporting Trump, but surely they are part of it because they're going to figure out where they are now, where they stand now.
Right. There are serious conversations that need to be had within the Republican Party and also within among people, as David was talking about, who are conservative and who support the Republican Party and support their candidates and their leaders. I think one of the ways to remarry reality to a lot of the folks within the Republican Party is to have leaders within the Republican Party who start talking truth again, who start talking about what's really happening, doing away with the theater of outrage and all of that, but dealing with, okay, this is what the problems are, here's where we are as a country, and here is our solution as a Republican Party, as conservatives, and have that argument based in fact, and have that come from the number one elected leader within the Republican Party, which right now, correct me if I'm wrong, David, is still Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, on down. When we have leaders who speak truth to their constituents, that is when it takes hold. And so far within the Republican Party, that has just gone like that.
David, you want to pick up on that? I mean, what I'm wondering, what is it that Joe Biden is inheriting here? As he steps into the presidency next Wednesday.
Well, our NewsHour friend Mike Gerson wrote George W. Bush's inaugural speech in 2001, and that was a bitterly divided election, if you remember 2000. But Mike went back and looked at that speech this week, and he said, we could still count on an underlying unity of the country, and we could appeal to that in the inauguration. And Mike said, I look back on that speech, and it seems so naive now. And so it's a bitterly divided country. But the first thing Joe Biden needs to do is he needs to show physically, materially, he cares about people who think he despises them. And so he's got this $1.9 trillion COVID relief. It's got unemployment insurance. It's got up to the $2,000 check. It's got a child care tax credit. It's got all these physical manifestations of government saying, this is a hard time. I care about you. I'm helping you. I think if those programs went out to Red America, they would see that Joe Biden is not the doom of America, which a lot of people have convinced themselves he is, but there's actually someone who can help you. And I do think that's the beginning of turning around. They're not going to listen. They're not going to attach to reality until they feel that somebody cares and sees and hears them. And this has to be done physically, not just with words.
Jonathan?
Yes, I agree with that completely. And talk about a person who is the person for the time. I mean, if anything, if there is a word to describe President-elect Joe Biden, it is empathetic. I think it was the one thing, the one big attribute that he had that was his calling card in this election, that he was someone who, when he spoke and people looked at him, they felt in their bones, that he felt in their bones whatever issue that was hurting them. He felt their pain. And it's in every speech, it's in every comment, it'll be in every policy. And I think if the Biden-Harris administration pushes forward and keeps empathy at the top of their agenda, at the top of what they have to say to the country, I think they will succeed in showing all of America that they care about them.
So, David, finally, is it a good thing for Joe Biden to begin his presidency, back to impeachment, with an impeachment trial in the Senate competing for attention and for time and everything, for that matter?
Yeah, I completely support impeachment, think it's the right thing to do. I think it would be a bad thing to have the trial in the Senate. Joe Biden has to pass that legislation. We just had a horrifying report 10 minutes ago on COVID. That was horrifying. And so we need to solve that problem. We need to pass this piece of legislation. $1.9 trillion is a very complicated piece of legislation. I think it's got a lot of things a lot of Republicans can support, a lot of things Joe Manchin of West Virginia can support. And so you can get, I think that bill can be supported, and we can get $1.9 trillion out the door to the American people, but it's not going to be an easy lift. And maybe in Senate trial, A, takes up a lot of time. B, it'll stoke all the flames. The Republican Party will find it very easy just to go in opposition mode. I'd love to think that we can at least have a couple months of action before they go in opposition mode, and I'm afraid the trial will do that.
Jonathan, what about that? Is a trial necessary?
Yes, it is necessary. And this is my first time disagreeing with my friend David. It is necessary for what I said, the reason I said before, because of the message it would send to someone who might try what President Trump did in the future. You know, people elect senators to come to Washington to do hard things. And over the last few cycles, what we have seen is a Senate that gets nothing done unless it's confirming judges or voting on inconsequential legislation. They come here to do hard things, and there's nothing harder right now than holding a sitting president, soon to be not sitting president, but to hold a chief executive responsible for very bad acts, but also to help a nation that is reeling from a global pandemic and then the subsequent economic implosion.
So, David, I'm going to give you the last word, unless you leave time for Jonathan. Again, what about the argument he's making that this is something the country needs to do?
Yeah, I just think our legislative capacities are not very high right now. And doing a pretty confrontational and violent, not violent, but a confrontational impeachment at the same time we're trying to pass a very complicated and a lot of resistance legislation, I just think that's too heavy a lift for us. And so we have to choose, in my view. And I choose the COVID relief bill.
All right, Jonathan, you get 15 seconds.
I hear you, David. I just hope the Senate, I hope the Senate does both. They can do both.
Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, we thank you both.
Thank you, Judy.
As the U.S. death toll to COVID-19 reached another milestone, we want to take a moment now to remember some of the individuals we've lost to the pandemic. George Whitmore loved nature and spending time outdoors. He first learned how to rock climb from roommates while at pharmacy school in San Francisco. George soon became an expert climber, and in 1958 was part of the first ever team to scale El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. His wife said he was a humble and frank leader. He believed his conservation work for the California wilderness was his life's greatest achievement. George was 89 years old. Deborah K. Ivory was always smiling and full of life. Famous for her homemade mac and cheese and desserts, she served people from across Oklahoma City at her barbecue restaurant. One of Deborah's mottos was people over profit, and if someone couldn't afford a plate of food, she'd give it to them for free, her family said. She was 62 years old. Tiffany Shackelford was gregarious and made people instantly feel comfortable, her husband said. Raised in a Navy family, she lived all over the country, eventually settling in Alexandria, Virginia. She was a master networker and made connections and opportunities for people she encountered throughout her career in journalism, policy, and digital media. She was civic-minded and, among many causes, advocated for robust statehouse and local reporting. A dedicated mother, Tiffany was 46 years old. 96-year-old William Good was a dedicated physician and worked as a family doctor in California for more than 60 years. William survived the Holocaust in Poland, thanks in part to people who risked their lives to feed and house him, his son said. Becoming a doctor was one way he tried to give back, and he met his wife, Pearl, while studying in Italy. Later in life, William organized annual trips around the world to spend time with his three children and six grandchildren. Alicia Ugartechea was a sweet and genuine person, her family said. Born in Mexico, she moved to Arkansas in her 20s. Alicia was a hard worker and gained a loyal clientele for the clothing alteration business she ran out of her home. She also worked as a custodian at a local elementary school for 20 years and befriended many staff, her daughter said. Alicia was dedicated to her family and helped raise her five grandchildren. She loved shopping, traveling, and cooking for her family and friends. Alicia was 67 years old. Thank you so much to the family members who shared these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you, as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. And on the NewsHour online right now, can at-home testing for COVID help bring better access to underserved communities? We look at the options out there and how they work. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. Please stay with PBS tonight. We have a special program for you airing at 9 p.m. Eastern. Here's a look at that.
The siege of the Capitol, fueled by the president's own words.
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
The roots of rage run deep.
We could see it coming.
But how did we get here, and how do we repair what's been lost? American Reckoning, a PBS NewsHour special report, Friday at 9 p.m., 8 Central.
And we hope you'll join us. And stick around now for Washington Week, coming up soon on PBS with our own Yamiche Alcindor hosting tonight. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a good, safe weekend. Thank you, and good night.